From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the way we fund our courts. A new report finds that system broken.
The conclusion is really inescapable once you really look at how the system works in Michigan.
Road safety in the era of legal weed. Do we need a blood level limit for pot like alcohol? A state commission says no.
There's no way to ascertain, whether a certain level of THC in a person's system indicates that they're under the influence of the drug.
The rowdy history of Detroit's legendary rock magazine, Cream.
There was very much a sort of a kill your idols approach to music journalism. Nobody was too good to be taken down.
Plus MSU's championship dreams shattered by the upstart Red Raiders.
Texas Tech right now is playing the best defense I might have ever seen in this tournament.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you're a defendant standing in court before a judge, you expect justice. But in Michigan, what you also get is a judge who needs money from you, the defendant, to help pay for expenses, not just for the court, but in many cases for the county as well. And that's raising questions about money's influence on our justice system. The Michigan Trial Court Funding Commission spent 14 months studying our court funding system. And today, it came out with a 43-page report boiling down to this conclusion: our court funding system is broken. Ingham County District Judge Tom Boyd is chair of the Trial Court Funding Commission. Judge Boyd, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Help us understand that system. How are Michigan's trial courts funded now?
The trial court is funded with a blend of money from local taxes, revenue generated by the courts themselves, the costs that you referred to, and then some state money and a small amount of federal money. About a little over 40% comes from local taxes.
Okay.
And a little over 25% comes from money that's gathered by the courts to help fund themselves. Some of the money that's gathered by the courts is then sent to the state and sent back to the counties. It's a complex spider web of statutes that moves money back and forth like some sort of a money laundering scheme to move it around.
And in saying it's broken, why is that?
Well, the commission first had a very open-minded look at the way the process works. And we came down with a list of problems or concerns. The first of those is the one that you've mentioned, that's the real or perceived conflict of interest between the judge's impartiality and the obligation to use the court to generate revenue. And in spite of that pressure, we also found that there's an inadequate funding from all sources, with an excessive dependence on local government funding, which isn't necessarily stable in the current economy. And finally, that this led to an unequal access to justice, which harms those who are most vulnerable and have the least financial resources.
So as a district court judge, have you experienced pressure to raise money, bring in the dollars?
I'm very fortunate that the current Ingham County Commission is very supportive of the mission of the district court as an agency to create safer communities. But when I first began, I was summoned to the commission to explain why I wasn't bringing in enough money to support the court and other government functions.
And when you see, digging into this real or perceived conflict of interest between that judicial impartiality and that obligation to, fill the coffers and raise money, what can that mean for defendants?
Well, nothing in the report suggests that financial punishment shouldn't be a part of a sentence. So it isn't to say that criminals who can afford to pay fines shouldn't pay fines. We're not saying that at all. The question is, should there be a connection between the amount of money that comes into a court and the amount of money available to run the court? That's the corrupting link that we're pointing out and suggesting needs to be fixed.
And in real life, is there a case that sticks in your mind where you feel that some defendant was really put in the wrong place because of this pressure?
There are numerous examples all over the system where people are caught up in the fines and costs. As a result, people within the community feel that the court's really not out for justice or about for public safety, but just out for money. And so they focus on the money aspect considerably. If you think about, one of the presentations that the Trial Court Funding Commission had was from Chirag Baines, who was a official with the U.S. Department of Justice, who wrote the report or assisted in writing the report on Ferguson, Missouri. So if you remember Ferguson, it was a situation where the police and the courts used their authority for civil infractions and minor misdemeanors to raise revenue to run the city. And eventually, with the unfortunate interaction between police and a citizen that led to his death, the community revolted. But the Justice Department's report showed that the death was only the match that lit a fuel-soaked stack of hay, which was the way that the courts and the police had treated the community. So this disconnect between the community and the court's role to provide justice needs to be addressed. And our report suggests that the community, when they conclude the court is more focused on or too focused on revenue, as opposed to simply a just outcome in each case.
If you've just joined me, I'm talking with Ingham County District Judge Tom Boyd, who's chair of the Trial Court Funding Commission, which is released today. It's 43-page report examining our court funding system and concluding it is broken. And how do Michigan's courts in this system of funding compare to national best practices?
You know, interestingly, when we looked at the problems first, as I've described, we then compared it, held it up to the mirror of national best practices. And what you see there is, in each instance, we're 180 degrees from where the recommendations from the National Center on State Courts and other organizations that describe best practices. So they specifically talk about the fact that the courts shouldn't be funded by their own revenue. They specifically talk about the fact that general fund revenue should be used to support the courts and that this type of a conflict shouldn't exist. They specifically talk about uniform funding and standards that are across the board. And Michigan fails on almost every one of those standards as it relates to funding.
What did your commission find to be the main barriers to having an effective trial court funding system for our state, one that looks much more like the national best practices?
What the Trial Court Funding Commission in this report suggests is five relatively simple recommendations. I'm not saying they'd be easy to do, but they're relatively straightforward in their articulation. And the first is that the money shouldn't stay locally with that unit of government. If you can imagine the old concept of a speed trap, or if you believe you have one in your community today, the reason that that's done may be to make that street safer, but it might be to enhance revenue for the local unit of government. And if all the money that comes into the court goes off to the state, as we recommend in our report, the incentive for either the police or the court to increase their revenue goes away. So then they only have the motivation to do what is just in the case to enhance public safety in their community. So one of the main recommendations we've made is that the money that comes into the court not stay locally, but goes off to the state. And then with an infusion of state dollars, that money is sent back to the locals in an amount appropriate to run that court. So one of the things we found, as I mentioned earlier, is an inequality in the way that justice is administered. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that some local communities have more money than others. So the idea here would be that we would have a level playing field as it relates to access to justice and the services provided by the courts.
That's an important change. Is there any other important recommendation that really you feel that needs to get out there that people need to understand?
What we're talking about is starting to increase the state's participation in funding trial courts so that the burden on the local community can be lessened, although it's very important that the local community maintain the efforts that they're currently putting forward in supporting their trial courts. It is a partnership between local funding units and the state. In that partnership, we suggest that the state offer to take over all technology. This would, again, ease access to the courts and enhance the user's experience because one court's computer system would be just like any other court's computer system. Today, the trial courts, specifically the district courts, spend an incredible amount of time arresting people. Well, I shouldn't say that. The police arrest the people, hold the people, and then the court talks about money that's owed. So the court system becomes more of a tax collector than a court. And so we're suggesting by sending all of the revenue and all of the collections to the state, the trial court system gets out of the tax collector function.
Challenges to this system have made their way to the Michigan Supreme Court, especially People versus Cunningham, where the court ruled state law does not provide courts with the authority to impose costs on criminal defendants to fund day-to-day operation of the courts. And that leads us to a case that is now before the state high court, People versus Cameron. What's at stake in this pending decision?
It really flows naturally from Cunningham. So the legislative fix to Cunningham is being directly challenged in Cameron. In other words, the defendant in Cameron, as part of his sentence, was assessed costs to fund the court that convicted him, just as the legislature allowed after Cunningham. Defendant, Mr. Cameron, is challenging the constitutionality of that legislation. We don't, in this report, begin to guess what the Supreme Court will do. What we've tried to do is create a model or a system that would succeed without regard to the conclusion. If the Supreme Court says everything's fine, the recommendations work and they fix the problems that we've identified. If the Supreme Court says there's a variety of different problems or defects constitutionally with the current system, the report recommendations facilitate solutions to that. We don't provide the money. We're not the legislature. We didn't try to overstep our responsibilities and get into what the legislature might do with that challenge. But we've detailed a system that would fill in the void and allow the legislature to make the hard decisions about how to fund the trial courts.
And I know this interim report of the Trial Court Funding Commission is going to the governor and to the legislature and to the Michigan Supreme Court. I have to ask, what do you say to the why should I folks? I think a lot of law-abiding citizens might ask, well, why should I have to pay for a criminal court when I follow the laws? I don't use the criminal court. What's wrong with charging people who've done something that requires them to appear in court?
Again, there's nothing to suggest that people who commit crimes might not have a financial responsibility. The question really becomes, who benefits from the criminal justice system and the judicial system? So, is the drunk driver really the only person that benefits from his or her arrest? The answer to that is no. We all benefit from public safety and from law enforcement and courts doing their jobs. And so, like every other general obligation of the government, we all should be pitching in to support those things financially. It is directly because of the real or perceived conflict of interest that the national best practices suggest you can't only rely on those people who are committing the transgressions, violating the law, to fund the system, or you have the perverse incentive to find people guilty when they're not, or to punish them more severely than you might have otherwise. Those are the real harms that the American system is set up to prevent, and that we are potentially falling down on the job.
Ingham County District Judge Tom Boyd, chair of the Trial Court Funding Commission, releasing its 43-page interim report today examining Michigan's system for funding court operations. Thank you so much for being with us. It's always great to talk with you, Judge Boyd.
Thank you.
After the break, the latest news from the marijuana front in Michigan. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, there's been plenty of movement on marijuana in Michigan, both medical and recreational. Michigan Radio Steve Carmody is tracking these moving parts. And Steve, let's start with something very important to marijuana businesses, which is money and just what has to happen for banks in Michigan to handle their money. What's the existing roadblock?
Well, the big existing roadblock right now is that federal law basically says banks and credit unions can't do business with companies that deal in marijuana because marijuana is still illegal on the federal level while it's legal on the state level in Michigan and about 30 other states. So a congressional committee, the House Financial Services Committee, passed a bill that would allow banks and credit unions in states like Michigan where marijuana is legal to do business with marijuana businesses, and that would solve a major problem that marijuana businesses have.
Basically, a workaround for marijuana businesses.
Yes. You know, right now, marijuana businesses operate on a cash-only basis. And if you think about it, there aren't that many legitimate businesses that operate on a cash-only basis. So by allowing marijuana businesses to deal directly with banks and credit unions, it will allow them to do things like get loans, take credit cards, actually do their banking and not be saddled with a lot of cash.
Something tells me marijuana industry leaders and marijuana business owners are very pleased at this development.
Oh, absolutely. The folks I talked to last week said that this will be a big step towards making them just a normal business like any other business in the state.
So this is a House committee. So what are we thinking as far as what could happen to this bill in the House and then once it heads to the Senate?
Well, the bill passed 45-15 in the House Financial Services Committee. So it had all the Democrats on the panel and quite a few Republicans. So its possibility of passing on the House floor is pretty good. It'll probably have the votes it needs to pass. The Senate could be another issue because there are companion bills in the Senate right now, but it's unclear whether the Republican leadership that controls the Senate will take up this legislation.
Okay. Now we go to a court of claims judge that has blocked the closure of 50 medical marijuana dispensaries. Again, tell us what this is about.
Well, the dispensaries faced a March 31st deadline to obtain licenses to operate in the state. Now, they've received extension after extension after extension for months and months and months, partly because the state has been taking so long to go through the whole process and grant licenses. So they've been getting a lot of extensions, but state regulators decided months ago that, you know, March 31st was going to be the deadline. That's it. You have to have your license by then. Or beginning April 1st, they were going to start sending out cease and desist letters to those provisioning centers that did not have a license. Well, as the deadline grew close, some provisioning centers filed a brief with the Court of Claims, and the judge put a stay on the state's plan to shut down these provisioning centers. He's scheduled a hearing, and that'll be a chance for the state and for the provisioning centers to make their case, either to go forward and start basically shutting down these unlicensed provisioning centers, or to keep them open and put pressure on the state to get more of them licensed.
Because it seems very clear that what I'm hearing from you is that the bottleneck, it's not on the part of the provisioning centers, it's on the part of the Michigan Marijuana Licensing Board that has to go through all these applications.
Yes and no. Yes, they've been very slow in getting these applications approved. But I've also heard from some folks that not all these applications have been meeting all the requirements that the state requires. So that's another reason why they're not getting approval. So it's a complicated process. There are things on both sides that need to change in order for more of these provisioning centers to get licensed. And it all is sitting now before a judge in the Court of Claims.
And that will be on April 9th, that hearing. And finally, a state commission has made a recommendation about whether or not to set a blood level limit for pot. So what's this commission and what is it recommending about blood levels for pot?
Well, this commission's been meeting for quite a while. It was enacted as part of some legislation back in 2016. And what it was trying to do was trying to determine if there could be a test for THC, the active ingredient in marijuana, similar to what we have for blood alcohol level. We're all used to the idea that at a DUI stop, a police officer, you know, would check someone's blood alcohol level, and if it's above 0.08, then that person's in violation of the state's limits on alcohol. The problem with THC, the body ingests it differently. So this panel, after looking at all the science out there, has just determined there's no way to ascertain, you know, whether a certain level of THC in a person's system indicates that they're under the influence of the drug. So it puts more of the onus now on police officers doing the standard field sobriety testing, the walk in a straight line, touch your nose, all the other things that they do to determine if someone is impaired. And it takes away that bit of evidence that's very helpful, an actual physical test that they can point to say this person's impaired. Now it's more of can he determine just by eyeing the person whether they are under the influence to a point where they are impaired?
So it seems like from what you're saying, the science with this, you know, uncertainty of THC, how it's used in the body, we could wind up with false positives or false negatives if they set a specific level.
Well, I think it's just a matter that the science just isn't there to be able to say that this level of THC indicates an actual impairment level. Because, again, the way the body ingests THC, you could have a lot of THC in your system, but it may no longer be active and affecting your judgment and affecting your ability to drive a car.
States with legal marijuana have seen an increase in stops and arrests for impaired driving. What are police and prosecutors expecting to see here in Michigan?
Well, I would imagine that they're expecting to see what they've seen in other states. But it's, again, it's a difficult thing to assess, partly because, yes, they have seen an increase in the number of DUI arrests for marijuana, But then again, most of the law enforcement folks who I've talked to in other states admitted they weren't really looking for it as much as they are now, or they didn't have the training that they have now to determine if someone is impaired from ingesting marijuana. So yes, it could very well be that more people consuming cannabis products are being caught for DUI. It could be that the improved training that law enforcement officers are getting just means that they are catching more people that they were missing before, or both could be true. There could be more drivers on the road who are impaired because of marijuana, and the police are doing a better job of catching those who are impaired on marijuana.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody. As always, Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And if you have questions about marijuana in Michigan, whether medical or recreational, just send us your question. You can email us at stateside@michiganradio.org, and we will do our best to find your answer. It was renegade. It had no use for manners or convention. It was profane. It was rock and roll. It was Cream, which billed itself as America's only rock and roll magazine.
That's right, Cream Magazine. If you want a free copy,
3729 Cass Avenue. Clear out their offices.
Don't cost you any money. Just send them a letter with your name and address to where?
3729 Cass.
In Detroit, Michigan, the Motor City.
Cream was founded in Detroit in 1969 by Barry Kramer. The story of Cream is told in a new documentary, Boy Howdy, the story of Cream Magazine, directed by Scott Crawford, with music by Wayne Kramer, co-founder of the MC5. It'll get its premiere in Detroit April 10th, the opening night of the Freep Film Festival. Here with us is J.J. Kramer, son of Barry Kramer and producer of the film, and Susan Whitehall, who was an editor at Cream from 1975 until she left for the Detroit News in 1983. She is an associate producer of the film. It's good to have you both back on Stateside to talk about Cream.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
Thanks for having us.
You know, J.J., we'll remind everybody, we've talked about this on Stateside, your dad actually started Cream selling it out of the trunk of his car, but eventually it set up offices in Birmingham. So how influential was this magazine, issues being sold every month, and how widely read was it?
Well, the trajectory of Cream is quite incredible if you think about it, starting in the Cass Corridor, being sold out of the trunk of my dad's car. And then as the magazine's circulation grew, it moved from the Cass Corridor, as you mentioned, to offices in Birmingham. And at its apex, Cream was second in circulation to Rolling Stone. So it kind of went from this underground paper to this regional tastemaker to a national powerhouse. And it's really incredible when you think about it in retrospect.
Susan, I'm wondering if you can give us adjectives to describe the Cream newsroom with the personalities of the unholy trinity of rock journalism, Barry Kramer, Dave Marsh, and Lester Bangs.
So it was kind of nutty, but it was very friendly. And the people who you thought might be scary were not. Like, I used to come up and there would be Lester, the big teddy bear. He would have the biggest smile on his face and he'd be greeting me and like he'd been waiting all day for me to come. And I thought he'd be the scariest. And Jan was always the one who said to me, so-and-so is not going to give you an assignment. I'll give you an assignment, which she did. It was a lot. It was girl power at that point. And once I got in, though, Lester was very helpful and he was a mentor in terms of my writing and he'd go over every sentence. But it was crazy in terms of, yeah, we were playing music all day, and then we were arguing about music all day. Barry would order us dinner, just like our dad. And then Lester would take half an hour figuring out which albums to give to the delivery guy in lieu of a tip.
I think as I watched the film, as I watched Boy Howdy, the story of Cream Magazine, especially the Cass Corridor days, it kind of reminded me of dorm life away from home and just kind of crashing there. And and Cream was so different from Rolling Stone. And I'm wondering, JJ, do you think that's a function of being based in Detroit versus in New York? Or was it Barry Kramer versus Jan Wenner?
I think it was a little bit of everything. I think because Cream was not on the coasts, it definitely had a different perspective, a different aesthetic, and a different voice. I think there was very definitely a Detroit-sized chip on everybody's shoulder that worked there, and there was very much a sort of a kill your idols approach to music journalism. Nobody was too good to be taken down, and at the same time, you could have an issue where an artist was both heralded and destroyed in the same issue. There was a famous review of Lou Reed's Metal Machine Music in one of the issues of Cream, where the review was just the word "no" printed over and over and over again.
And that was by Lester.
Yep. And I think in that same issue, there was also another review that was championing Metal Machine Music. So it was just sort of flying in the face of convention. And whereas Jan, I think, was very concerned with Rolling Stone being a culture magazine, Cream was very much a rock and roll magazine. And that wasn't just something that they said. That was something that they lived. It wasn't just a magazine about rock and roll. It was a rock and roll band putting out a magazine.
Who are some of the artists that we see in the film talking about Cream and what it meant to them and how it opened their eyes to rock music?
Well, Michael Stipe is one of my favorites in the film of REM. And when I first heard he was being interviewed, I thought, well, what can he say? He was talking as a reader, how it affected him being from a somewhat sheltered environment. And it was hilarious. I won't ruin it.
Well, actually, let's take a listen. And we've got that clip pulled. Let's hear it. Michael Stipe of REM.
Most people want to fit in somewhere. Because of my otherness, because of my queerness, I was trying to find that gang. I wasn't going to find him in my high school. I found him in Cream magazine.
Susan, how was it for you watching the final cut, seeing all of these people part of Cream telling their war stories?
So it takes me back into the newsroom and back into the editorial department in a good way and sometimes in a fraught way because things would be up and down, and it was 90% happy and fun. But then, towards the end, when Barry started getting ill, it was a little fraught. But it really makes me laugh more than I thought, because even Ted Nugent, he's pretty ridiculous, but in a funny way. And I really enjoyed interviewing Peter Wolf. He's got a great story about Lester coming on stage, and they put it into cartoon form, and it really works. And
yeah, there's a lot of very deft touches besides using that great old film stuff that, I'm sure that was a treasure trove. But I like that animation that kind of told this story.
And I asked JJ, where did you find that clip of Lester and me and Duncan? And it was in your basement, right? Mm.
Yeah, it was in an unmarked box on an unmarked tape.
Wow.
In my mom's basement. And I picked it up. I said, well, this looks old. So maybe there's something here, because it was one of those big video cassettes, like bigger than a VHS or Betamax. It was it just looked like it could have some treasures inside.
We had been looking for that for years.
And JJ, we should remind everybody, as they'll learn when they see this documentary on the story of Cream magazine, you were 4 when your dad died in 1981 and left Cream to you. So you were a magazine mogul when you were 4.
Yeah. At 4, I was chairman of the board of Cream magazine. So it was pretty cool to go to show and tell and talk about having a rock and roll magazine. I was kind of a little punk about it back then, but kind of looking back on that and going through the exercise of putting the documentary together and just hearing about how my mom, with Sue's help, kind of stepped in to help manage the magazine and publish the magazine after my father died. It's really incredible. And it's one of those things that often goes a little bit overlooked in the history of Cream. After my father died and my mom became publisher, her first phone call was to Sue to kind of chart a course forward. And to their credit, Cream's circulation actually improved for, a handful of years before the industry and the dynamic in the MTV era caused everything to change. So it's really a testament to the entire team that stepped in after my father passed away.
It was quite a 20-year run for Cream. What story do you hope people will take away from seeing the film, Susan?
Oh, that you can do incredible, edgy, creative work right here in the middle of the country. And don't ever underestimate us. Don't underestimate Cream. Don't ever underestimate somebody with a head shop in a dying city. you know, because he might just surprise you and put together a magazine that's better than Rolling Stone.
JJ, how about you? What do you want people to learn, not only about the magazine, but about your dad, Barry Kramer?
I think, you know, in addition to what Sue said, it's just this incredible testament to the rock and roll spirit, the do-it-yourself mentality that I think Detroiters definitely embrace. It's if you don't like how somebody's doing something, you roll up your sleeves and do it on your own terms. And to have such an iconic magazine be published in Detroit and bucking convention when most media was headquartered on the coast, it's really just this incredible legacy. And as it relates to my dad, I hope people can see him as the flawed genius that he was. He was definitely a visionary, a provocateur, and someone who had very, very strong and powerful relationships with almost everybody he came in contact with. And that was, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that's the story that we set out to tell.
And boy, howdy, the story of Cream Magazine is the opening night film for the 2019 Freep Film Festival. That's April 10th, but there will be other times and locations as part of the Freep Film Festival. And you can get all that information at freepfilmfestival.com. So whether you live through it and it's walking you through your life, or you're younger and you're wondering what was it like then, it's the best way to kind of get a sense of rock and roll and rock journalism, primal, profane, and irreverent. And it's a great film. JJ Kramer, Susan Weidel, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, incarcerated Americans have disproportionately high rates of mental illness, but many jails and prisons don't provide adequate treatment.
Their budgets are set by state legislators, and nobody ever really runs on, I'm going to improve health care for prisoners.
We'll hear about a new model to improve mental health care in prisons. That's next on Stateside. Stay tuned. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Every year, some 4 million people are released from our prisons, and nearly a quarter of them have suffered from major depression. Many have not gotten adequate treatment while they were incarcerated, which means they return to society in worse mental shape than when they were first incarcerated. A team of researchers led by Michigan State University has come up with a cost-effective way to deliver better mental health care in prisons. Jennifer Johnson is a professor of public health at MSU's College of Human Medicine and is the lead author of the research. Jennifer, your study is breaking new ground. I know it's the first randomized study for major depression in a population of incarcerated people. So what's the scale of this problem? What did you find?
So this was an intervention study, right? So the scale of the problem has been established before. About 25%, 23% of prisoners will have had major depressive disorder. And, you know, prisons and jails do the very best they can with the resources that they have. But given that, you know, more than half of the people in prison and jail have mental health disorders, and the resources for treating them tend to be limited, often there just aren't enough providers to go around. So one of the things we did in this study was that we looked at, is there a way to provide a standard treatment for major depression that we could make more cost effective? So we made it into a group intervention. We used some prison mental health providers, but also some providers that weren't necessarily trained specially in mental health or substance use counselors or reentry planners to see if we could use them as service extenders to reduce the cost.
So the idea is to try to find a more cost-effective way and to just get more people into these prisons and jails to be able to work with prisoners who need it. And, you know, when you stop and you think about 15 million people touch this criminal justice system in our country every year, what does it say that this is 2019 and yours is the first study looking at how to effectively treat depression in prison?
You know, it says that we tend to neglect the health of those who are involved in the justice system. You know, there is, I think, a knee-jerk reaction that people have that they think that people in the system are other or different or fundamentally separate. And I probably thought that before I started working in the system. You know, you think about what you see on TV, you see bars and people who are going away for life. but that isn't the vast majority of people who are involved. 10 million of those people per year are going through what they call pretrial jail detention, which is where you get arrested, picked up, held for a few days. You may or may not even be charged. And it's interesting because I think that there is this sort of sense that people involved in the justice system, they must have done something wrong. So we're very concerned with, you know, what do they deserve? What do they not deserve? But, you know, providing adequate health care isn't condoning crime. And, you know, one in 34 people in the U.S. are currently involved in the system. They say that probably one in 10 men in their lifetime will be behind bars. So we just incarcerate so many people here in the United States that we can't ignore their health, because the health of detainees is public health.
Can you give us perhaps a real life example that you might have studied? What happens when people do get out from a prison, get out from jail, and they have not gotten effective treatment for their depression?
You know, it makes everything harder. Getting released is very difficult. I've worked with both women and men, but I've worked especially with women. And sometimes people feel better when they get out, but a lot of times their depression may actually get worse when they get out, because they go out to all the same problems a lot of times that got them there in the first place. You know, the boyfriend who says that he is clean and has a place to live is living in his car and dealing drugs, or, you know, they're worried about their children, or they may have to make choices between going to substance use treatment or, you know, being with teenage children who may be in trouble and may really need them. Their lives are complicated. And, you know, depression is known to have effects on your ability to function, your ability to find employment, your ability to think things through. So it's just that much more difficult to deal with all the things you need to deal with coming back into the community when you're depressed.
Jennifer, can you give us a sense of the, you were saying they do the best they can, prison authorities. What kinds of mental health services are typically available to people who are incarcerated in Michigan?
So in prison, you know, in the states where I've worked, the most common intervention is medication. And everyone in our trial that I led had major depressive disorder. Many of them were on medication and it just wasn't doing the trick for them. We found, though, that often people are reluctant in prison to identify themselves as having a mental health problem. Sometimes that can interfere with parole. Sometimes, you know, they don't trust the prison mental health providers, or sometimes they do want treatment, but, you know, resources are scarce. I wondered, in one of the states where I was working, I looked around and realized I was the only PhD level provider in the state besides somebody who was running the entire state mental health service. And when I thought about why that was, I realized, you know, the administrators know about the mental health need. They know, in essence, that part of what they're doing is running a treatment facility, but their budgets are set by state legislators, and they are answerable to the public, right? And nobody ever really runs on, I'm going to improve health care for prisoners.
Yeah, you're right.
That's the problem. And if you hear anything about incarceration, you know, during campaigns, it's, I'm going to put criminals behind bars. So it's tough. And, you know, a lot of folks actually are more effectively and less expensively treated in the community. There's a lot of research evidence that shows that for substance use in particular, treating people in the community is just as effective in reducing substance use and crime, and is about a third of the cost of incarceration. And, you know, the same goes for mental health. So our policies don't necessarily reflect that. And then jails actually are even harder. Jails are at a county level, and the money is appropriated at the county level, and people are in and out so quickly. You know, they may have 30 people coming in every day. You know, I've known jails that had 13,000 people a year going through the jail and one day a week of a psychiatrist.
Boy, that's a lot of unaddressed need. And when you stop and then you think, if people get out in worse shape mentally than they were before they went in, then society is going to pay a cost there.
Right. And, you know, whenever you incarcerate somebody, especially for a short amount of time in jail, you typically disrupt their medications, right? If they're on medications for mental health issues, you know, even serious mental health issues like, you know, psychosis or mania. And so sometimes the jails are able to get them connected to care in the community, but oftentimes people are just in and out so quickly and the jails are so under-resourced that they can't do that.
So in your study, you and your colleagues, you trained a team to treat 181 inmates through something called IPT, interpersonal psychotherapy, and you found that actually helped more than the medication or whatever was happening prior. What is IPT and why does it work?
IPT is one of the two best validated psychotherapies for major depression in the community. And I would say, you know, between antidepressants, something called cognitive behavioral therapy, and interpersonal psychotherapy or IPT, those are the three frontline treatments for major depression. And what IPT does, as a therapist, you talk to the person and find out when their current down mood started. So not back when they were 12, but, you know, maybe 5 months ago or 10 months ago or whenever it was. And, you know, talk to them about what was going on in their life. And oftentimes it falls into one of four categories: grief, a life change. It could be going to prison, getting out of prison, divorce, losing kids, you know, in any of those kind of things. Conflicts with people who are important to you, or social isolation. And then what IPT does is it works to set goals in those areas and to help people address those issues and build social support. And what's interesting about it for prisoners is that the prevailing wisdom is that interventions for prisoners need a lot of structure, behavioral change, and that's true. That is absolutely true. But the things that keep people in the justice system up at night are those things. You know, they're worried about their kids. They're worried about their mom. They're worried about, you know, will their partner be faithful? Or, you know, if the partner is abusive, should they go back to them or not? Or, you know, it's these very human things that keep people up at night, and providing them a place to talk about those things and really deal with those issues was unique and very important.
So your study used, as you said, master's level health therapists, bachelor's level reentry counselors. So that let you get help to more people without having to hire new mental health professionals. So tell us, after the treatment sessions, could you measure an improvement? What did you see? What kind of effect did it have on the inmates?
You know, relative to prison treatment as usual, adding IPT reduced depressive symptoms significantly, reduced hopelessness very significantly, reduced post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, and increased rates of remission from major depression.
So it made a difference.
It did make a difference, yes. And, you know, what was interesting is the effects on hopelessness were particularly strong. And we didn't see effects on suicidality because there weren't really high rates of suicidality in this particular sample, but hopelessness is strongly related to suicidality. So reducing hopelessness matters because then they can go on and try to make things be different.
So you are offering this up to really to corrections departments around the country as a possible system of treatment that is cost effective, seems to work. What is the next question you want to study?
The next question is how to help the systems adopt it. We've already had calls from one state, for example, and their challenge was that they could afford the initial training, but they couldn't afford some ongoing check-ins to make sure that the therapist stayed on track. So the next question is how to make the training process as streamlined as possible so that prison systems can use the intervention, the providers can get trained in it in the most cost-effective way possible.
Jennifer Johnson, professor of public health at MSU's College of Human Medicine and lead author of this study published in Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology. Jennifer, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's Stateside, we'll talk about how working in a prison impacts the mental health of the corrections officers.
Correctional officers across the nation have a higher propensity towards drugs and alcoholism, divorce, and suicide.
We talk with an officer from a Jackson prison about the mental health challenges she and her colleagues face on the job every day. Join us tomorrow on Stateside for that conversation. And you can always join the conversation by reaching out to us on social media. Tell us, what stories are you focusing on or issues that you want to hear more about? Just let us know. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And of course, you can always go to michiganradio.org and click the link that says Stateside.
Well, the Washington Post team of Chuck Culpepper and Des Beiler said it best. And here's the quote: "The burrs and the thorns and the briars and the barbed wire of the Texas Tech defense snared another beast on Saturday night. left it stuck out there in the cold reality for which the only escape would be a flight home. And that cheerless flight droned toward East Lansing, Michigan, because of that 61-51 loss. As Tom Izzo put it Saturday night, it wasn't our night, it was theirs. They're moving on and we're done. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon is there. That pretty much summed up what happened.
I think those two quotes from both the Washington Post as well as Coach Izzo pretty much do it. The Washington Post, by the way, Mark Twain had a great line. He had a few great lines,
yes,
didn't he?
He did.
But one of them was, if somebody says it better than you can, quote them.
Well, I thought that said it all.
And I didn't have that lead. That's great stuff.
It sure is. Would you have predicted it to be Virginia and Texas Tech tonight?
I failed to predict Texas Tech's last three victories, so I'm not the right guy to ask. I thought certainly Michigan was going to beat those guys. I thought the question was Gonzaga in the next round. And then Texas Tech plays Gonzaga, a one seed. They beat them.
I mean, they just mowed through them.
It's amazing.
Northern Kentucky, you know, Buffalo, exactly. Michigan, Gonzaga, and then Michigan State. So,
and
what's
two
the
shockers against Michigan State.
Yeah.
One is that Coach Izzo had basically a solid week to get ready for Texas Tech. Now, the way the format goes, you usually play one team on Thursday or Friday and then another team on Saturday or Sunday. 2 days between your weekend games, which is very difficult to prepare for. Yeah. You have one practice. Their guys are tired. You can't run them. So it's all chalkboard stuff. But you had a week in this case to get ready for this team. Izzo's clearly a very smart coach. He's got Cassius Winston, as we've said, one of the smartest point guards I have ever seen, a U of D high graduate. Mm-hmm. And they fell into exactly the same trap as Michigan and Gonzaga. Texas Tech right now is playing the best defense I might have ever seen.
Amazing,
in this
right?
tournament. And not a lot of offense. This is not a talented team, frankly. These guys are not going to the NBA. Maybe one player out of this batch, honestly. They're in their fourth and fifth year seniors, which you never see in basketball. If you're any good, you're gone after a year or two. So you got these 22-year-old guys playing ferocious defense, and they're beating great teams with it, including both Michigan and Michigan State.
It threw Michigan State off so much. We watched Matt Mooney from Texas Tech just sink basket after basket. And we were all, I think everybody watching from Michigan, from the state of Michigan, was expecting to see the kind of same action that we saw against Duke. And it was like everything was off.
Everything was off. And you always feel like, okay, your team, poor shooting night. Michigan was 0 for 18 from three-point, which is partly defense, of course.
Yeah.
But once a good defense is in your head, once they're starting to mess with you, all your timing is off, your rhythm is off, and your mojo has disappeared.
And gosh, that's what we saw. Yeah.
It's like getting rattled before a big interview. Once that happens, all your stuff goes out the window.
So Tom Izzo's been to eight Final Fours, and he's won it all one time. What needs to change that narrative and get that win?
Luck. That sounds pathetic. But look, eight times, it sounds bad, one out of eight. But look, in a Final Four, you're supposed to win it, what, one out of four times, right? They're all good in a Final Four. It has never happened otherwise. All teams in the Final Four can play basketball, or else you don't get there. It's really simple. If he'd won, you know, this time around, then he'd have two out of eight. That's one out of four. That's completely average. So a few in there, he probably should, you know, maybe could have won in the, you know, Butler, teams mm-hmm. like this. But for crying out loud, this is where the, I think, what did a comedian said? Everything's great and nobody's happy. And that's how I feel about sports these days. Michigan football had 10 wins. Fans are unhappy. 30 wins in basketball. Only the fifth time in 100 years, basically, Michigan's done that. Michigan State, three banners. Big Ten regular season, Big Ten tournament, and now a Final Four. You get a banner for that, and you deserve one. Yeah. Three banners. Everybody, relax. This is good.
All right, so let's talk about how this season sets up MSU and Michigan for next season. So MSU, I know they say goodbye to seniors Matt McQuaid and Kenny Goins.
Right. Two big players.
Big players. We
tough
all
players.
Yeah, even if you watched casually through the season, you saw it in the big dance.
I don't know if they're NBAers, but they're
important.
Solid team players.
So what about the rest coming back, and how's recruiting look?
Recruiting in both cases, can't quite tell yet, but in both cases looks pretty good. With both Michigan and Michigan State, the most important recruiting John Beilein at Michigan and Tom Izzo at Michigan State are going to do are bringing their guys back. And both coaches have shown ability to do this with Burke at Michigan, with Miles Bridges at Michigan State. Okay. If these players they currently have are borderline NBA players, they probably shouldn't go. They might be tempted to go. The money's out there. I think in almost all cases, they should come back for one more year. If they do, you've got two top five teams going into next season. If they don't, you're rebuilding.
But none of them are Zion Williamsons, where everybody's like going right to the top of the NBA.
Zion Williamson, I guarantee you, Coach K at Duke has no illusions. And if that guy went to any classes in January, I'll be shocked.
All right, who's your pick to win it all tonight, Virginia or Texas Tech?
Let me be wrong four times in a row and pick Virginia.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator John Eubagen. As always, John, thanks.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.